I'm Anne Strangechamps, and we've heard a lot of complaints about the American election system this year. Micro-targeting, dark money, vote rigging, gerrymandering. But today, onto the best of our knowledge, we're going to put aside the problems and focus instead on solutions. Ingenious, off-the-wall, counterintuitive ideas for making American elections better, fairer, and more fun. Now, some of them are going to sound a little crazy, like letting 10-year-olds vote, or making people pay to vote. Philosopher Jason Brennan's idea is to roll back democracy and only let a few people vote. He told Steve Paulson that's because the average American just doesn't know enough.
The average voter in the United States knows who the president is and pretty much nothing else. They can't really identify who their congresspeople are. They don't know much about ideology. They don't really know much about the social sciences. They don't know the basic facts that might be relevant to the election. And non-voters, the people who stay home, they know even less.
So you're saying that those ignorant voters, that's your word, they shouldn't be allowed to vote, right?
I think it's worth thinking about alternatives to just straight democratic voting, where we give everybody an equal right to vote regardless of their background knowledge. And maybe to kind of soften people up on this, think about the following. Why don't we allow 8-year-olds to vote? So I have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they're not legally allowed to vote. Why don't we let them? So two reasons people might give. One is that they think they're under the influence of their parents. But the other thing people will say is, well, those kids don't know anything. Why should they vote? They're ignorant. They can vote later when they know something, but they don't know anything right now. But the adults aren't really much better.
So you want a system where basically only the high information voters are allowed to vote, right?
Well, there's a number of different ways of doing this. So the technical term for this kind, any of these sorts of systems, was dubbed by a philosopher named David Esland at Brown University. It's called epistocracy. So that comes from the Greek word episteme, meaning knowledge, and krasia, meaning like rule of or power of.
So this is the rule of the knowledgeable.
Yeah, that's right. So in a democracy, every citizen has equal voting rights sort of by law. In an epistocracy, in one way or another, citizens can acquire more power in virtue of knowing more. So one way of doing that is to give everyone a right to vote. But if people have certain credentials or if they pass a quiz, they might acquire an additional right to vote. So this is a system that the economist John Stuart Mill advocated in the 1800s. Another way would be by default, no one has any right to vote. But if you pass a quiz, you can acquire a right to vote. Another system that's been advocated by a Mexican philosopher named Claudio Lopez Guerra is what's called the enfranchisement lottery, where by default, no one has any right to vote. And then right before the election, you select about 20,000 citizens at random, and they and only they acquire the right to vote, but only if they first go through some very basic competence building exercise. And finally, a system which sounds kind of convoluted, but I really like the idea of it, is what I call government by simulated oracle. And in a system like that, what happens is everyone gets to vote. But when you vote, you take a quiz of basic knowledge, you write down your demographic information, and then you write down your policy preferences, or you vote for a candidate or something like that. But then instead of just taking what the people actually support, you use that information to statistically determine what would happen to the American public if they could score 100% on that quiz. So in fact, they'll probably score like a 30% on average. But if I magically were to ramp up their knowledge to 100%, what would they support? And if you have those three bits of information and you have, you know, 20,000 people voting, and really hundreds of thousands or millions of people voting in the real world, you can then determine, and anyone who's taken statistics could determine, what would the people support if they were knowledgeable? And the idea here is you do that rather than the thing they in fact support.
Of course, the problem is, historically, this is a really fraught question because there were certain groups that were excluded. I mean, for a long time, African-Americans weren't allowed to vote. Women were not allowed to vote. And then later on, even once African-Americans were given the vote, at least in the South, they had to pass certain tests to prove that they were competent. And given all of these systems that you, or most of the systems that you've just proposed, I don't see how you get away from the inherent problem of an epistocracy, that it would seem to favor people with more education, higher incomes. In our society, people who are mostly white, aren't these going to be the people who basically end up ruling the country?
Yeah, that's right. So at least one system, the government by simulated oracle and also the enfranchisement lottery, those are designed in a way that can overcome that problem sort of inherently. But the other systems will be ones that will have that issue. It might not be quite as bad as we think. So one is to think of it as a comparison thing. In the U.S. right now, despite it being democratic, it still is the case that high-income, high-IQ, employed, richer people, privileged people run things. So even thinking about, you know, the worry about high-income voters or privileged people voting, it's worth noting a couple interesting features about democracy. So one is, voters don't vote selfishly. We tend to think we do. Everyone believes that he or she votes for what they perceive as justice, but everyone else is a jerk voting for their pocketbooks. When political scientists study this, they find that voters vote altruistically. They vote for what they perceive to be the common good of their nation. So people tend to vote altruistically, and that's true of both parties. It's true of pretty much every ideology. The question is whether they measure up in terms of cognition.
Now, it seems that the devil's in the details here. And so, I mean, in terms of this question of political competency, who gets to set those standards of knowledge? I mean, I can't imagine constructing a test to sort of, you know, determine whether someone is up to speed or not that all sides would agree to. I mean, there are huge controversies, for instance, about what gets into school textbooks about how to teach U.S. history, and the stakes here would be so much higher and I would think so much more controversial in terms of which questions and answers get put into these competency tests.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I don't think there's any really way to avoid that, to be honest. One way to get around that is to make it fairly basic and just require knowledge of particular facts, just what's the unemployment rate, what's happened to the economy in the past year. Can you name your current congressperson? Can you name how many people are on the Supreme Court? Just very, very basic things.
Well, why do some of the, nice like, is, even like, what's the unemployment rate? Why do I need to know that to be able to vote? I don't see why that should determine anything.
Well, think about the recent Brexit vote as an illustration of this. So you can think about what facts would be relevant to Brexit. Something like, how many immigrants are there in the UK? How much money is going back and forth between the UK and the rest of the EU? And here's an interesting finding. So they ask all the voters in the UK, how many immigrants are there? What percentage of the UK is made up of immigrants? The people who voted leave estimated that it was something like 40%. And the people who voted stay estimated that it was something like 20%. And the truth was about 10%. So you look at the basic facts that might be relevant to the election, what's happening to the economy. And if people have those facts wrong, they're going to make mistakes about what we should do.
So in the Brexit case, you're saying that those ignorant people who just got everything totally wrong, they should not have been allowed to vote, and the Brexit vote would not have been approved.
If we did have a system in which, suppose your knowledge of the relevant facts were in some way empowered you, it was conditional upon your knowledge of the relevant facts, then yeah, they would have voted stay. And even afterwards, you can see regret from the voters, because after the Brexit was decided, a lot of these facts were published and people started studying them, and they're like, wow, I guess I didn't understand how many immigrants there were, and I didn't really understand what the economic value of trade with the EU is.
So you've presented various alternatives to democracy. I mean, sort of this rule of the knowledgeable that you are calling for. Is any of this happening anywhere in the world? I mean, do we have any case studies of successes here?
No, not really. But, you know, there are things that we could do that are legal, I think, that would get us closer to being an epistocratic system. So suppose you had a rule, and many people who consider themselves ardent Democrats, pro-democracy, are okay with this rule. We change the voting age, and you're allowed to vote only, say, between the ages of 30 and 50. So really old people and really young people can't vote.
You can get drafted and sent off to war at 18, but you can't vote till you're 30.
Yeah. Well, I oppose the draft too, by the way. So let's get rid of that while we're at it. So if you had just that rule, that would make the American voting populace much better informed, because that's the age group at which people have the highest information. Really young people and really old people tend to be very low information. Middle-aged people have higher degrees of information. That, I think, is probably consistent with the 14th Amendment, whereas some of the stuff that we're talking about would require a radical change in the Constitution. It wouldn't be constitutional.
It sounds like, I mean, partly what you're trying to do here is you're trying to say, okay, it's not exactly clear if there's a better system, but let's take a really hard look at democracy, because it's not as great as everyone thinks it is.
Look, we don't really know if epistocracy will work better. In the same way, if you were writing in the late 1700s and you said we should have democracy instead of monarchy, you didn't really have good support for that. You had some theoretical kinds of claims, you had some sort of mathematical arguments, but at the same time, like when you look around in, say, the late 1700s, you have two sort of democracies, the U.S. And France was a disaster, and the U.S. wasn't obviously any better off than it had been under British monarchical rule. So later, after we actually experiment with democracy, it becomes clear that overall it works better than the alternatives. So I think something like that's going with epistocracy. We can look at problems with democracy. We can theorize about how it might epistocracy might improve upon it. But we would never know for sure unless we actually experimented with it in the real world.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening.
Steve Paulson talked with Jason Brennan, a philosopher at Georgetown University and author of Against Democracy. We're talking Elections 2.0 here on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International.